Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
At the time, there was a lot of experimentation with what constituted a record that you were, like, when you'd buy a record, what do you get with it? Like, you would get a record with a sleeve, and sometimes there'd be an insert, or if you were lucky, there would be like a poster, or there were the first big black record. I was into the idea of making each of the records unique and making each of the records somehow directly personally related to me.
Hello, everybody. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. I want to welcome you to this episode. It is a sad day in the world of music, especially in the world of indie rock, because earlier this week, Steve Albini passed away at the age of 61 years old. And we are here today to discuss his legacy and talk about his overall impact over, more than 40 years being in this business. And joining me now, I think very appropriately, is the host of My Noise on Rockin' the Suburbs Radio, Vasant Ramamurthy. Vasant, how are you?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for doing this. I think you're an ideal person given your background and experience with all these kinds of music. And I think I have to say more than anything, this, Vasant, you texted me around noon, I guess it was on Tuesday, and when the news began to break, and I was truly shocked. I mean, I thought this must be some kind of hoax or something along those lines. Did you have a similar reaction?
Yeah, I mean, I have a news feed running on my computer that I just look at while I'm working, and the Pitchfork story popped up there. That's where I saw it first, and it was, yeah, just to read that headline was just completely shocking. So yeah,
it really was. It's one of those things, you know, for me, and I'm probably older than you, Vasant, but Steve Albini has been someone that's been kind of in my musical life from the beginning when I, you know, started listening to stuff and getting into punk music. And, you know, not only was he an incredible musician with, three notable groups, one of them, we'll just call them the unfortunately named band. And he was also an incredible writer. Early on, I was very influenced by his tour diaries for Big Black and other, you know, recording things that he wrote for Forced Exposure magazine. And he had a journalism degree from Northwestern University. He was a very talented writer, continued to make inroads in that space. And then, oh, by the way, he founded a fairly successful recording studio and recorded many influential records. To your mind, Vasant, is there one part of that legacy that stands out more than the others?
I mean, one thing which I think people may not know about is that his sort of generosity in terms of the music community, specifically in Chicago, but larger. Like, a lot of people have this impression of him as kind of a, prickly a-hole type, which is, he himself would admit was justified. Mm-hmm. But people may not know in the Chicago area, every year he's involved in a charity called, I think, Letters to Santa. Basically, poor families would receive like Christmas presents, every on Christmas Day. And he and his wife and his other friends would basically on Christmas morning hand deliver these Christmas gifts and stuff to families who needed it. And he would do a annual sort of 24-hour marathon of comedy, music, other things, and got a lot of people to participate, like Jeff Tweedy and Fred Armisen, people from the Chicago scene and people he knew. I think Dave Grohl even did it like last year or something. Wow. to raise money for that. So that's kind of one aspect people don't know about. Besides the music, people may know he was a accomplished poker player. Yeah. So like a champion, won like, you know, couple hundred thousand dollars in poker tournaments and stuff. He liked cooking as well. So I think on his Instagram, he's, would post pictures of, you know, pretty elaborate food he made and things like that. So yeah, a lot of, different facets of his personality were interesting, I think.
Yeah, very well said. And, you know, it's interesting. I read somewhere there was a musician or a friend of his that had passed away. And at one point, Albini said, I want to be, you know, when I go, I want to be like that. I want to have tons of stuff that I've unfinished. You know, I want to have appointments and, you know, constantly being involved in life and doing all these things. And it's certainly, by all accounts, seems like he was. And obviously, it's a terrible shock and a terrible loss to lose him, but in that sense, he kind of was in that full-on motion, you know, that he talked about at all times. And I was also struck reading some of the obituaries that how much time that people said he would have for them, whether it was a social media post or if you sent him an email or came across him in person. He was incredibly gracious and would spend time talking to you and, you know, answering your question in the most thoughtful and honest way that he could. And that was, I think, another overriding thing about Steve Albini was his unflinching honesty. I think later he came to say, I'm not the same person I was when I said that or did that, you know, especially regarding some of the early stuff. But he judged himself and tried to be as honest and fair and artistically honest as he possibly could, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely that's one aspect that people didn't like about him, is that he would, you know, diss other bands. You know, in the 90s, there was a big thing in the Chicago music scene with him sort of disowning Urge Overkill after they got popular. He did produce one of the records, and then after they started, you know, sort of getting in their 70s dress-up kind of thing and signing the major label, he, like, pretty publicly, you know, diss them. And then Smashing Pumpkins, obviously, that was a big kind of feud with them. And then but yeah, like you said, I think in recent years, given that he's been on Twitter and social media and sort of done a fair amount of interviews and podcasts, like, it's pretty interesting to see him openly say, you know, about his some of his writings and actions in the past, you know, how sort of ill-informed they were and stuff. So that's definitely something to be appreciated.
Yeah, absolutely. I continue to have respect for him. And you had to admire his intelligence, you know, no matter what he was talking about. Obviously, he was very smart and thought about things very carefully, or thought about them a lot anyway. And for those who don't know, I'll really quickly run through his musical output. He started a band called Big Black when he was at Northwestern University, and they put out four EPs and two albums starting in 1982, and they went all the way through the year 1987. And he was the guitar player along with Santiago Durango, and Dave Riley was the bassist. They had an earlier bassist who I believe went on to play in Naked Ray Gun. Was that? It wasn't Jeff Pizzotti, was it? Okay.
That's right. Jeff Pizzotti was the first bassist. Okay. Yep.
And then he had, after Big Black sort of reached kind of a mutual end, and they announced that they would be breaking up before they did. They did some tours afterwards, and the sense was that they just were kind of relieved that it was all over, and they sort of celebrated what they had achieved. Very abrasive at times, very raw. They used a drum machine. They didn't have an actual drummer. We'll be right back. then formed, as I mentioned, the unfortunately named Rape Man, to put out an album and an EP in 1988, and played with the rhythm section from the Jesus Lizard, which was incredible. I got to see that band a couple times, and to see him playing with a live drummer after seen him play with the Roland 608 or 808 or whatever a drum machine was really a revelation. And then his band Shellac sort of blended the two extremes of Rape Man and minimal guitar trio work. I think they're a pretty underrated band. They didn't do a whole lot and never, really did as far as, big extravagant promotion or record sales or anything like that. But they had put out 5 records, and unreal at the way sometimes these things happen in life. They had a new record that was scheduled to come out. I believe, was it next week, Vasan, or something like that?
This week or next week, right, I think.
Entitled To All Trains. So there were 5 quite outstanding Shellac albums, spaced apart pretty broadly. How did you get into Steve Albini's music?
Yeah, his bands, I think it was probably Big Black was the first of his bands that I heard. And it was definitely through, I think I've mentioned this before, but like the Spin Alternative Record Guide. It was my sort of Bible in the late 90s and high school years. And so that I think I've read about them in that and, got that record. So that's the first one I heard, yeah.
Can you remember what your reaction was to hearing them for the first time?
The music was definitely interesting. Mm-hmm. I think the lyrical content is probably was more more kind of a slap in the face for me, because I was not listening to any bands that, like, I won't mention the album title, the particular one. It's has some profanity in it, but like, starting from there and some of the songs on there. If you're whatever, 17-year-old kid, it's definitely a new experience listening to that band.
Yeah, it was the same for me. I mean, they took on topics that were extremely uncomfortable, yet you knew existed. And, it was interesting, Albini being a journalism major, he often sourced some of these things from newspaper stories and, the song Jordan, Minnesota, for example, and used very provocative language. And as you said, the music was, their guitar sound was something that it's hard to describe how metallic and tinny and punky it was all at the same time. And
it's not a warm sound.
No.
At all.
Even though they had a bass, the two guitars. And I have to say, over my many, many years of concert going, to this day, I think my ears probably just stopped ringing a couple of years ago. I saw Big Black and Pussy Galore play a double bill at the old 930 Club in Washington, D.C.
Wow.
And it was by far the loudest thing I'd ever heard in my entire life. I think I lost a good portion of my hearing that night, because it was one of those pin yourself to the back wall. People were actually backing up from the stage because it was so incredibly loud. But it was a very unique, and there weren't a lot of bands at all that sounded like that. And I think their influence definitely trickled out in a lot of different ways. And like I said, he was very philosophical. I remember reading in one of those forced exposure tour diaries, a sort of a manifesto of some kind that he had created for bands. Like, if you're starting a band, here's what you shouldn't do and here's what you should do, And being messing around in a band myself at that time, it was just like, wow, this is, never seen anybody that came, philosophically like this. I was able to see, as I mentioned, Rape Man one time at a very iconic DC punk venue called DC Space, where essentially the whole Discord scene kind of began in many ways. And this kind of tells you the story, at least from my opinion, about what kind of character Albini could be in person. He loved to provoke, and he loved to see what kind of reaction he would get out of people. So we went to the venue, and DC Space was very much a kind of DIY venue. You brought in the PA if you played there, and you had somebody watching the door. And when we got there to go in, there was another band that was playing And they were playing first, and it was Steve Albini on the door collecting the $5 for everybody who walked in. And, you know, just like, hey, how you doing, Steve? Hey, man, thanks for coming. And then proceeded to get on stage and tell, I don't know, 7 or 8 Ian MacKay jokes to the audience, starting off with, why did the punk rocker cross the road? He was safety pinned to Ian. And, you know, that's not something you did in D.C. I mean, Ian, you know, was a towering figure and remains so to this day. It was, I don't think necessarily he had any personal beef with him. He just wanted to see how people reacted if he actually went about
it. They're friends. I mean, so yeah. I don't think there's any animosity there. They had a mutual respect. And actually, Albini produced some sessions for the Fugazi In on the Killtaker album, which didn't get released because I think neither side was happy with the results, but, you know, something they tried.
Yep, I think I remember that. Famously, he didn't want to be referred to as a producer. He wanted to be referred to as an engineer because he didn't want to think that he had a tremendous, you know, wasn't part of the band, or he wasn't, right. You know, one of those people. He wasn't Bob Ezrin on Kiss Destroyer. And there's something that really struck me. I was messaging with Scott Parks yesterday, and he said of Albini's production style, he said, quote, he was so good at just getting out of the way, but giving the exact information bands needed and made them sound their best because he did that. And I thought that was a very insightful kind of comment. Would you concur with that from what you have read and understand?
Right. I think absolutely. Like, if you look at his discography and, you know, just it's a very egalitarian approach in terms of who he recorded. So he obviously recorded Nirvana and Bush. That's probably the two most popular, you know, selling mm-hmm. bands. And then Page and Plant. I mean, we're talking, you know, Page, what more do we need to say about, you know, in terms of popularity? I mean, that's the peak. But then he also just recorded bands you probably have never heard of just from the Midwest or whatever, you know? So there was no, like, saying yes or no to whoever, depending on their popularity, right? And he, the bands would tell you he would put in the same amount of care and effort into setting up the room, the mics and all that thing, whether you were Jimmy Page and Robert Plant or you were just a band from Minnesota or something, you know?
That definitely speaks to a lot to the way he went about it and the way his attitude toward being a professional engineer and running a very accomplished studio. And gosh, I don't know anything about this, but I sure hope that there is somebody that's going to be able to take up the mantle or the torch for that electrical studio there in Chicago and continue to keep it running, because it's an extremely important and vibrant part of the music scene.
Yeah, for sure. Right? I mean, but from what I understand, he was obviously very generous with his information. So it's not like he you know, kept things to himself. So he shared information about techniques and recording and all that. And I'm sure there's the other, you know, people who work at the studio will, you know, kind of have an idea. Of course, it's never going to be the same as how he would do it. But then, you know, hopefully the studio is able to stay open and continue to serve the community.
Yeah, I really hope so, too. I always found this so funny that for somebody, and my introduction was Big Black, and that's how I first got into it, and they used a drum machine. For somebody who used a drum machine, to get the drum sound that he created, that he became famous for, just kind of blew my mind. It's got to be one of the greatest engineering drum sounds, because you hear certain records and you know where the drums are recorded,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, just the bass and the drums. If you're a rhythm section being recorded by Albini, that's just your dream, right? Just to be able to get your instruments heard like that and sound like that is just, yeah, must have been unreal.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, that he could record, say, something like the last three, I believe, Magnolia Electric Company records with Jason Molina, which is obviously something very different from, let's say, like what he did with PJ Harvey or others, is it shows a remarkable ability to understand art and musicians and where they come from.
I would say made his name with more sort of noisier guitar-driven bands like Nirvana and Pixies and PJ Harvey and stuff, but he was a big champion and love recording some more quieter sort of roots bass artists, like you just mentioned, Jason Molina. There's an artist named Nina Nastasia, who's a singer-songwriter. He recorded a bunch of her albums. Joanna Newsom, I think, did at least one or two. So I mean, those are all very different sounding stuff. I think Robbie Fulks, even the sort of all-country artist, had an album done by him, so sort of all over the place.
And, you know, it's interesting to have a band with, you know, like Bob Weston, when we're talking about Shellac, was also a recording engineer, but to have your own studio where you worked and are comfortable to be able to take your own band in there and kind of record is pretty interesting. And I think some of that speaks to the separation of years between the Shellac albums. They kind of put them together piece by piece. It wasn't like they went into, you know, and did a whole big, you know, long session. They sort of recorded things when they got them written and had the time to do them. Where do you put Shellac kind of in the modern musical landscape, Vasant?
I would say, I mean, it's not a hugely popular sound. I think there are some bands who sort of carried it forward in later years, like McCluskey, who I know you like, right? The British band. So, they were very Jesus Lizard and Shellac influenced. But I think, they have a dedicated following. And just because they're have just put out sort of so few albums over the course of 20 years, maybe they haven't been able to, get traction or get a buzz. But I mean, like, I don't think any of them particularly cared either, right? So they just do what they do.
That's a great way to put it, too, because I think they're almost like this sort of, I don't want to say acquired taste, but in certain ways they are. They're almost like, I was thinking about this the other day, in many ways, they're kind of like a postgraduate course when it comes to like punk rock and post-punk, right? They've absorbed so many incredible influences that they display them very subtly, but in many cases, they sound like a really good, loud rock band, but they've also got this other level of sort of minimalism and these little influences that pop up here and there. And I will also say that Steve Albini was somebody for me who helped me discover a lot of music, because he was always championing other bands and, you know, not only recording them, but talking about them and writing about them. He wrote a lot of reviews and things in forced exposure and other places. And, you know, we wrote a couple sort of semi-legendary, like, manifestos about, you know, music and major labels and all these different kinds of things. So he would turn you on to other stuff, too. And, you know, often he would play with bands that were, you know, that were cool, and tour with them and all those kinds of things too, or talk about them. Have you seen Shellac live?
I have seen them twice. Once was in, I think it was 2001, where it was a show Fugazi, Shellac, and the X played in Chicago. So that was a great show. And then I saw them again, I think it was 2006. There was a Touch and Go, it's the 25th anniversary, I guess, sort of festival, three-day festival. So I saw them there, and I also saw Big Black, which is basically their only reunion they did. I think they just did like three songs. It was very, very short. But yeah, I did see that.
That's amazing. Yeah, I've read about that and heard about it, but that's really, really cool. Yeah, and, you know, again, given to his approach and philosophy toward music, that would be the only reunion they would do four right. songs in a hometown festival. Yeah, that's very cool. I have seen Shellac once and found them very, very interesting to watch and listen to. Although I gotta say, I do, for them anyway, and maybe that's just part of me getting older, but I really do enjoy listening to their music, probably more than I would enjoy sort of experiencing it live these days. But was lucky enough to see Big Black a couple of times, just because they played in DC and DC had such a vibrant scene that they were, you know, always invited and were part of all those things. The other thing I would like to mention that I found really interesting in reading some of these tributes and things was his forum that he had for electrical audio apparently became a very big rallying point for a lot of people. Did you know anything about that or kind of its influence or impact?
I haven't read it in a while, but from what I understand, you know, what I mentioned before about in terms of sharing information, asking questions, you know, he was active on that, would answer questions about recording and share information, things like that. And there's definitely sort of a community that, you know, centered around that. I believe they did some, like a barbecue kind of show every year or so, before, at least pre-COVID they did, you know, based around that. Smaller bands and stuff would play. So it's definitely, you know, a strong part of the Chicago music community, I would say.
Yeah, amazing. And I think that might be where, because I read somewhere that he and Bob Weston both shared their, like, guitar and bass setups, like their amps and all their pedals and, you know, for gearheads and pedal heads. It was, like, amazing to see what they actually used to create these sounds. And, yeah, he was, like you said, by all accounts, not secretive in any way about the methods he had and just worked hard to ensure that what he did was right. And, you know, like you mentioned, an excellent poker player. He probably put all that money into pedals or whatever he won or more equipment for his studio. So it's a tremendous loss. It really is. And I think not only when you sort of look at social media and see all the different artists who are paying tribute but regular people who had touched, you know, whether he met them after a show or they had a fanzine and they did he did an interview with them or anything like that. His influence was pervasive. And I don't know. There's, you know, I still feel a sense of shock about it for someone who was older than me, but not a whole lot. And, you know, somebody you feel as a contemporary, it shows you that, you know, things are precious, but that to accomplish these things and to put out all this music and to touch all these people was an incredible life's work that he actually
put absolutely together. I mean, the loss will be felt in all the various facets that I mentioned, right? So starting from the charity work that he did and the recording knowledge, and just from our, you know, sort of selfish perspective, the music listener, just being able to hear albums that he either made or recorded.
Yeah, and He was survived by his wife, who's a filmmaker named Heather Winna, and you mentioned Vincent, her work in that charity that he does, and all the things he did in Chicago with the inner circle of friends that he had, and you know, he claimed, at least according to the a couple of different obituaries, that he recorded probably a couple thousand albums at his studio. So it's amazing to think that all that music is out there, which is, yeah, it's really kind of mind blowing. So rest in power, Steve Albini, a real giant in American music. Vincent, you are planning a tribute on your Rockin' the Suburbs radio show coming up. Tell us a little bit about, is that going to cover a couple
shows?
Yeah,
I'm planning to do a two-parter. So assuming this airs on Friday the 10th. So my show is on Rockin' Suburbs Radio on Friday nights at 5 p.m. So today I'll be having part one, and then plan to do a part two for next week because there's just too much to fit in one. So just spotlighting some of my favorite work of his, trying to maybe focus on the lesser known stuff. So yeah.
Okay. And what would you say would be some of your favorite stuff from
him? Well, definitely I would say In Utero is my go-to Nirvana album. Okay. So that's one out from the Breeders. I think I like Pod over Last Splash. So that's another one that he did. Another band that he had a huge hand in is the band Silkworm, sort of a lesser known indie rock band, but he did most of their key albums on Matador and Touch and Go. So they're one of my favorite bands. So so a lot of those are some of my favorites. Jesus Lizard, which you mentioned already. What else? Yeah, I definitely dig that PJ Harvey album, Rid of Me.
Yep.
And then just too many to even think of. Yeah,
it is. Once you start spooling them off, it's kind of incredible. Cloud Nothing's another band that he worked with. Yeah, that was very cool. And if, as you mentioned, McCluskey. I mean, I think I'm so glad you brought up Silkworm. That slipped my mind. But Silkworm and McCluskey, the drum sound he got for those two bands really, I think, helped propel them, those records he made, really into another orbit, because those are kind of the bands that had that kind of drum sound but really benefited from him getting it just right. So great shout on Silkworm too. Another band who ended sort of tragically and unexpectedly, but a great overlooked band. Really good. Well, Vincent, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate you bringing your knowledge and perspective of all the music that you've listened to, and especially being around the Chicago area and understanding kind of his impact there. It really means a lot. So thank you very much.
I mean, I wish we didn't have to do this, but you know, that's life.
Yeah, me too. Well, thank you for being here with me to get through it, and the shock will wear off, but we will have the music that will carry on, and I think maybe we'll play out with a little Silkworm to give everybody a good example of that drum sound we're talking about. Rest in power, Steve Albini. Of course, as always, if anybody out there has experiences, whether you met Steve or saw a particularly important show that moved you, or any memories of his bands or his production work, we would love to hear from you. You can create a voice file and send it to rock@suburbspod.com. It's probably the best way to do so. And anybody who wants to weigh in, maybe we'll do a roundup episode if we get some comments from there. Or if you have any questions about Albini or anything that you're curious about, feel free to send those in, and Vincent and I can work on it for you. All right. With that, Vincent, thank you very much. I am Patrick Foster, and we will sign off with a little Silkworm and say rest in power, Steve Albini, and we will talk to you guys next week. Couldn't you wait? Your certain time to allow. for somebody who used a drum machine,